Well, Dale, we're a week away from Fine Gael or Ardesh, with Simon Harris becoming leader and him then becoming Taoiseach on Tuesday. Did you expect this?
No, I don't think anyone expected it, Dave. It's really, I think we're heading into the Ardesh now at the weekend. I think it's pretty symbolic of, I think, the change that's happening at the moment. There's going to be, I think, a lot of energy, I suspect, at this moment of change. And with, the new Taoiseach being elected next Tuesday, new cabinet being announced, and all of the final shuffling on the deck that's happening in the coming days, with special advisors being appointed and who's in cabinet, who's out of cabinet. So I think it's a big moment for the party. But I think there's also balancing that, a recognition that, we've less than a year to go to a general election. The polling is challenging, I think, to say the least, for the party right now. And I think the challenge is to get re-elected for a four-term government, for some ever, for Fine Gael, is going to be pretty challenging. So I don't think anyone expected this. I'm not sure someone else expected this himself.
Yeah, I mean, Leo Varadkar's departure was a pretty big surprise. He really did take everyone off guard. He, if I'm right, is going to be leaving office as now the youngest, I think the youngest ever former Taoiseach. In fact, he's now leaving office at an age just before Bertie Ahern came into office, because he was the youngest Taoiseach at the time. If I'm right, the order now goes Simon Harris being the youngest, then Leo, then Bertie. As being youngest, but Leo will actually leave office before Bertie even came into office, which is quite an achievement. Harris then comes in a year younger than Leo into office, and it really does speak to how there's been quite a refresh and renewal within Fine Gael in government. It's a hard thing to do, to be in power for so long and to kind of refresh your faces. You've seen this in the Tory party, where they've had so many different leaders, and that could be seen as a source of weakness. But what Harris is now going into, because Coveney is not making himself available, is he will be leading a cabinet that has no members from Enda Kenny's original cabinet back in 2011. So you are talking about a complete refresh. Now, does that mean that you are getting a different party, i.e., you're getting a different set of policies, platforms, approaches? I mean, in many ways, it will be same old Fine Gael. It's going to be a party that is focused on small business, tuned to what agriculture is saying, trying to listen as best it can to Middle Ireland in the way that I think Fine Gael always kind of tries to do. But what will be a test of Harris, because of how this, I think Fine Gael has a challenge now to kind of distinguish itself in a policy way over the next 12 months, or whenever the election's going to come over the next year. That's going to be really tough. Can a new justice minister, if Helen McEntee is going to be moved, deal appropriately with crime issues and actually get a sense back that Fine Gael is a law and order party? Can we carve out some issues in the budget and on the business side of things, that actually maybe renew some enthusiasm from small businesses towards us and from the wider business community? That's going to be a real challenge. But take something like the what IBEC are saying. So IBEC are now putting out a big message on business costs ahead of the budget and ahead of the next new government. They're trying to say, look, we've got minimum wage going up, we've got PSRI going up, and we've got new sick pay things all coming at the same time. Can Harris actually deal with the business community and address those concerns, but also still steer us towards a national living wage? I am a big favor of that happening. I think that has to happen. You can't budge on the timeline for that. But could you stagger the other things on PRSI and sick pay? Maybe so. Maybe that's the angle that Fine Gael can take within the coalition.
I think it's it's funny. There's a few records being broken there. We're going to have our youngest ever retired Taoiseach at 45. I'd like to be retired at 45 myself, but and at the same time, Leo broke records when he went into office as Taoiseach in 2017 at the age of 38. We now have Simon Harris going in at the age of 37. And to your point about Enda Kenny, his legacy cabinet leaving with Simon Harris or rather with Simon Coveney leaving cabinet. And what does that mean? Will the public think that that's a renewed party? I don't think so. I don't think that it actually matters that much, whether it's a fresh cabinet from the original Fine Gael government in 2011 or whether it's more recent. I think what really matters is policy at the moment. And I think, for Fine Gael over the next year or so until the next election, to really think of, you know, what is their unique selling point and how can they drive home the issues that really matter to them. But I think fundamentally, you know, be it, the living wage elements, the support against cost of living, I think there's broad consensus on that. But I think fundamentally, all of this, I think, probably comes back to housing. And, you know, I think there's a timing implication for this is, the thinking was the government would probably go till October and then they'd have a general election there or thereabouts. Commentary now seems to be that it's going to go right until the end of its legal time frame, which is, I think, February next year.
Yeah.
And I think with that, they're going to want to basically pump out as much houses as possible. But I think also it's a time for Fine Gael to, I think, really once and for all maybe nail this issue and make it a core part of its economic program and policy platform for the budget and for its platform going forward into the election. Because I think, I think we've seen the homelessness figures in Dublin in particular creep over 10,000, I think. Was it? It was 10,000 young people, I think, wasn't it? Oh, no, it was 10,000 people in Dublin alone. I remember the days when it was 10,000 across the country where it was a problem. And 10,000 within the capital, of course, is a big challenge.
So that perspective is the idea that, okay, you have more time to actually solve these issues and you might get them solved. I'm a realist on this. Housing is a decades long issue to solve. You're not going to take that number from 10,000 down to 5 by the general election, and you're not going to make housing significantly more affordable come next February. February is always a crap month, or January is where the campaigning period for general election is. It's just after Christmas. People have no money. It's bitterly cold. It should be known by now that it's just a bad time to have an election. But irrespective of whether it's then or it's now, I think the housing situation isn't going to materially improve. Why do I say that? The ECB this week we've now seen inflation numbers come out across the Eurozone. Inflation is now at 2.4. And thank God it's down from the highs of 10 or plus percent that we had through the cost of living era. But with that low number, there's now talk that the ECB will begin to cut interest rates over the summer. That does provide immediate relief to existing homeowners, particularly those on tracker mortgages who get some relief. Anyone who's renewing on a fixed rate product might see some marginal lower interest rate. That's something for those people. But for anyone who's young people our age looking to buy a house, lower interest rates, if the banks pass them on, are only going to facilitate a step up higher in house prices. What we've seen over the past 2 years is that as interest rates up, it actually put a lid on the growth in house prices, which gave some relief to people. And we can now say that there's, I think, about 400 or 500 people a week who are now getting the keys to their first home. It's good that that number has stepped up. Hasn't made a difference in opinion polls to any of the government parties, by the way, including Fianna Fáil, who now have the housing ministry. But what I think will at least come about, or sorry, what I think is at risk for coming about by the end of this year, is if house prices just continue to tick up, even if it's not severe, like it's not going to be the 2021-22 house price increases that we've seen, but we have in the first 3 months of this year seen house prices tick up again. If that is just continuing into the later half of this year, then it doesn't matter when you hold election. I mean, the risk is you hold it in February and you're going to end up with that issue being more present in people's minds, house prices running away from incomes again. If that happens, that's just not a good environment for re-election.
No, I think the point here about, you know, can this issue be solved in a year? Of course it can't. And I think anyone who believes it can, I think is a bit fanciful. Same for the next government, even if it's not Fine Gael. you know, the party or parties that make up the next government will have to think about this. But what I think the key thing I'd get across here is finality in policy. When is this crisis going to end? You know, we've been talking about this housing crisis for nearly a decade now. And I think many people who, you know, have voted for the traditional parties over the years have been told, you know, how many housing plans and housing renewal plans have we had and big launch and PR elements happening over the last number of years. And we still have the same problem. We still have a housing crisis.
Yeah.
So I think...
Oh, go ahead.
What I'd say is, I think there needs to be, this needs to come to an end. I need to stop, you know, stop the crisis language for once and for all. And I think that's where Fine Gael has its, has a bit of believability in that, you know, it is, its roots are in, you know, good economics and strong foundational approaches for society and the wider economy. And I think there's an opportunity here for once and for all, lay out the roadmap. How will the housing crisis be solved, be it over 5, 10, or even beyond that in years, and make it believable?
Yeah, this is where I think come the election, you're going to see a big pitch from the main parties talking about the Housing for All plan, talking about how we're now up about 30,000 new builds a year, and that if you stair-step that higher, even into the 40 or 50,000 mark, that that's going to make a big difference to people's lives. The other thing that is going to become not a unique selling point, but a bigger selling point from Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil and the other government parties is social housing, which is now stair-stepping higher and higher each year. And where I find it just unique, very interesting, that if you look through the history of big social housing projects in Ireland, you look at the 1920s, just after the establishment of the foundation of the state, you look at the 1970s, where a lot of big things were built, they were actually coming well. And later Fianna Fáil in office, and then in the 70s, very much the government of Fine Gael Labour that did these things. Now Fianna Fáil also did a series of projects there as well. But actually, we're going to have this new record. Sorry, we already have a new record number of social homes we built per year, and that is another milestone that has actually been hit by Fine Gael being in government. So you're going to see Fine Gael begin to actually talk more about that as being a key achievement. I don't think it's going to turn around the perception, though, that's kind of stuck against Fine Gael, which is that it's a party that relies on the market. I still see commentary that gets written in column pages and on social media, which says, oh, Fine Gael is too reliant on the market. I mean, if you hit record numbers of social houses being built, that's not relying on the market. Now, that doesn't mean that there aren't also market mechanisms at play there. There's clearly been work done to actually allow a lot more big built-to-rent units to be built in places like Dublin and elsewhere. But that only corrects a massive imbalance we've had in Dublin and elsewhere, of very few apartments getting built throughout the decades gone by. I mean, Dublin is such a unique city in that you go from the city centre only about a kilometre or two out towards the canals, and you suddenly hit three-bed semis. Very few cities across the world have that setup. As you go out to the suburbs, you have much more mixed development of apartments.
Yeah, Toronto would have that settled, that structure pretty well, actually.
Yeah. And funny, I noticed the same. I was in Melbourne in Australia, and you do have cities where that can happen. But at least some of these cities counter it by having a much more dense urban core.
Well,
you do have, yeah, you'll have big 40, 50 story skyscrapers, at least in the centre too, and you may have some patches of back gardens in the suburbs too, but at least
we have
at least,
Liberty Hall.
I know, and it's a building which is there since the 60s, and then we built very few skyscrapers thereafter. Dublin has this just such unique profile, which is as if it's a city which has a spurt of development and it just kind of freezes in time, it feels like.
Mm-hmm.
But Dublin, to be fair to it, has actually expanded a lot. I mean, you know, Dublin's a city where if you talk to any emigrants who come home after years in Australia, they do talk about how the city changes. And God bless, we're not in some Italian towns and cities where people have left these towns and villages. And then they come back and they find that it's more derelict because people have actually moved out. You know, the demographics in some of these other places are really quite destitute. And that's what Ireland had after the 08 crash, was people leaving because there was just no jobs and opportunity. I mean, mm-hmm. I saw a piece in the Irish Times the other day, which really got to me. It was a profile of a, I think, an English language teacher who had gone to work in Sicily in the very southern tip of Italy. And she was talking about rent of, I think, about €300 per month to have an apartment or a place to live herself. That is that I don't knock the gain you get from getting that low kind of rent. But Sicily has one of the highest unemployment rates, not just in Italy, but in the entire EU. It's over 17%. The worst that Ireland's got was, I think, about 15% in 2011, 2012. So fine, if you can get cheap rent like that, you get it where others are suffering. You know, one person's rent, cheap rent, is on the back of someone else just not having enough work to afford any rent.
Rent prices are driven by the demand, and the demand of people wanting to live in certain areas and jurisdictions. And, you know, the reason why, you know, major global cities like London, like New York, like Paris, etc., command high rates of rent and housing prices is because those are the places of commerce and economics and financial services headquarters all across the world. And people want to live there. I don't think Sicily necessarily has such a magnetized effect to them. That said, it's a beautiful place to visit, and would love to go again.
Better weather than we have, I'm sure.
Better weather than we have, but I think at the same time as well, just on the piece around development, like, I think, you know, as these parties kind of, you know, are categorized by the columnists and the newspapers, you know, the complaint that Fine Gael has been given is around being too reliant on the markets, as you said, David. But end of the day, you know, the party in government, you know, it has launched, you know, one of the biggest social housing programs in the history of the state. I think the criticism actually that's more relevant in this situation is deploying that program a little bit too late, because we have to realize, you know, we went from, you know, the Celtic Tiger, where we had, you know, excess housing, which, you know, seems crazy now that we think about it, to a situation where we were effectively building no homes, certainly no social housing or state development of homes over the course of a couple of years, while we still had a high European population increase happening over those years. So demand was ever increasing, supply was ever reducing. And with that led to the challenge that we're facing now. So I think it's a case of we're playing catch up, but I think we have to play catch up with the policy now, tying back to our original point about, you know, what will the parties look towards here. It has to be once and for all, who will be the party who will lay out the roadmap for solving this housing crisis? What are the major steps? And who will be believed most in being able to do it? Because I think that is a challenge that's going to face the current government, who've been in office now for, what, 13 years?
Yeah, that credibility of who is leading it, you know, which of the parties can gain strength on that. I actually think Fianna Fáil, of all the parties, can come in to the next election with a bit of a fresher attitude to this. They don't have the record of 2011 to 2020, which was Fine Gael in office, where the housing budget was initially cut and then was rebuilt from nothing. They are able to take over and have that kind of half rebuilt housing budget and then talk about all the achievements. So Dara Bryant kind of comes into the next election with more of a cleaner perspective on housing, and they will be the outgoing.
It's almost like saying we crashed the car, but here's I bought you a new one.
yeah. Well, they're the mechanics now, at least trying to fix the car, and you know they're the ones that will present, you know, a finished car, not a finished car, but you know, something that's roadworthy to the Irish electorate. That may work in their favour. The question, though, you know, is housing going to dominate in the way that it did during the last election? So healthcare, if you look at the issues that tend to crop up at the top of voters' minds in recent Irish elections, healthcare is always number one or number two as being the most important issue. But it has almost become a kind of a perma crisis or a kind of a perma issue, which is because it's so high, it's hard to think of a general election since almost the Bertie years, which actually was swung on healthcare. So you go back to 07, I would argue that's an election where because Endakenny and Pat Rabbit came together with a kind of a Mullingar Accord. They presented, say, look, public services are not working. They actually got some votes back off Fianna Fáil at that election, and that didn't swing them into government, but it swung some votes away, and healthcare was big at that election. But in all general elections since, despite healthcare being really high, I don't think it's swung an election. Housing has swung the last one. And my just thinking on this is, okay, does the next election, even if voters say housing is number one, do they actually vote on the basis of housing? That's where things could really change, in that both the government parties just might be overlooked for the lack of housing. And other, like take immigration. Immigration is now so, that has moved up the list of issues big time. And if we're going to have, if it's still going to be big issue, because just today, maybe it was yesterday, the number of asylum seekers seeking asylum in the first quarter of this year versus the first quarter of last year is now 72% higher. So you're talking about over 5,000 people claiming just in those 3 months, compared to just over 2,000 in the same period last year. That presents a massive challenge for the state. If you're heading into a general election with people still in tents, because if you have 5,000 this quarter and every quarter this year, you're talking about 20,000. Even if it's 15, even if it's 10 or 15,000 in a single year, you may not have enough places to house those people. You still have hotels that are going to go to another summer season with Ukrainian refugees largely in them, but also other people in there too. That curtails the ability of businesses to actually have a decent summer. It stops people with part-time employment going into those hotels and working for them that might have otherwise done on seasonal work. All of these things are actually hitting such a wide number of communities across Ireland, because every local town has a hotel, or at least most of them do, and that is going to be so salient in the minds of voters having gone through another summer season like that.
Yeah, like, you know, my view on healthcare is, you know, first of all, there's been cross-party support for Sláintecare care. And I think, you know, they've tried to take the politics out of it and take a pan-party view that whichever government of the day is formed and whatever parties make that up, that the general macro policy of Sláintecare will go forward. And, you know, like, we've been in we've been in a perma crisis for a long time on healthcare. I don't think it swings the election. I think it's almost like we're almost numb to it at this stage. But I think the other issues around housing, you know, there's an element here around who is most believable. And, you know, it's, I think, fill me once, shame on me, fill me twice, shame on you. Or the reverse, actually, rather. You know, that's where I think, you know, it's an issue which has ultimately transcended the socioeconomic groups, where, and I think that's kind of gone into the polling as well, you know, those who are 18 to 35, you know, what party has gained the most support and commands the most support? It's Sinn Féin. Why is that? Because this is the generation of people who have been locked out of housing for a variety of reasons. I think there's an apathy that's built up from that. And I think so many other issues around, you know, starting families and, you know, building relationships and all of the life milestones that we go through that have been, I think, a bit delayed now, they all stem from this issue around housing and not having access to housing or affordable housing. And, you know, you have people who are, you know, young professionals sharing with three or four people, and then they can't build up enough of a deposit then to actually buy a home, and then they're locked out of it because of the housing, because of the multiplier that the central bank had in for a number of years, which is a bit punitive. So, you know, I think housing, in my view, is going to be the issue that I think significantly commands the swing of voting support. But I also think immigration is the piece that I think has crept up more recently. And I think, you know, part of the issue around housing, I think it's almost created a bit of a generalized anger within the country. But I think these comments are also applicable broad brush across Europe as well. Certainly I see it in the UK, from my view here in London, where, there's been a significant population increase in Ireland over the last number of years. And the commentary you're seeing put out online and exacerbated by, by the right wing, certainly see this a lot on Twitter, is that Ireland is full, and that, there's effectively no services or room for these people. So, whether right or wrong, that's debatable. But I think what you are seeing here, though, is there's an anger there that's being tapped into. And, where that goes, I think that's yet to be seen. We're seeing, you're starting to see on polling some of these right-wing elements starting to come up through support for certain independents or for certain parties starting to register now on the dial. But I think it stems from an anger. And I think housing is part of that.
On that link between housing and immigration, I'm surprised to date that there hasn't been enough people linking the two. Now, when I say linking the two, I don't mean to exclusively say that it's a bad thing, i.e. all immigration is putting pressure on housing. But so when research has been done in the UK, they've looked at what population increase does to house prices. And it's very clear that there is a link. For every 1% each point increase in the population, you can get up to a 2% increase in the average house price. Now, again, that doesn't mean to say that you shut down all immigration as the outcome from that. But I'm actually just surprised that no political party has actually begun to use the talking points. As you're saying, it is mostly the fringe, the far right, who are at best hyper incompetent in how they even communicate these things, and are really in the fringe. Some of them not even on traditional social media, on extreme social medias like Telegram, and that's not getting their message across, and then knocking on doors with very little impact. But take a party like Aintu, for example, who have talked a more restrictive message on migration and now hitting around 5 percentage points in the polls. Even they have been cautious not to kind of strongly link the two. They use more broad brush language. This is where the phrase dog whistling comes in, that you do see people leveling against some of these independents and Aintu for kind of, more broadly talking about the immigration pressure on services, talking about the availability of GP services, for example. That's a big thing in rural areas, not being able to get access to your local GP. That kind of messaging, if that continues into the general election, could well benefit the broader independents, maybe Aintu. Like, they're a party who I would expect, if they are featured in all of the broader party debates, this is where the TV debates is going to become a relevant thing. So let me just why do I bring this up? During the last general election, what really shifted the move towards Sinn Féin was the TV debates, because Mary Lou McDonald was initially excluded from them. And then when she was included, it created this sense of, oh, hang on a minute, there's a third option. It's not just about the two big parties that have been there since the foundation of the state. It is now about Sinn Féin, because they get to be on the same level as the two others in a three-way party debate. Now, my expectation for this general election, I don't know what Harris or Micheál Martin are going to do, but I would expect, if they have any sense, they won't do a three-way debate with Sinn Féin again. They will say, if we're going to talk, we're going to talk with all the parties there. And that means you have Sock Dems there, you've Labour there, you've got Greens, you have enough other parties there that Sinn Féin may actually get attacked from all sides. That's something that I think they would want. And yeah, if I was the two main parties, I would be saying, let's have Aintu on the stage as well. Because if you have Aintu on the stage, they are nipping away at Sinn Féin support. Because look, their founder is a former Sinn Féin TD. If you have the other left-wing parties on the stage, if you have Holly Cairns there, that's going to nip away the Sinn Féin support as well. The objective for the two government parties at the next election may not be increasing their own support, because the ability to do that in a very multi-party system that's probably going Dutch, where we have loads of different parties all at around 20%, no more. The objective for the two big parties is probably going to be get Sinn Féin down and doing a big, big multi-party debate, 8 leaders on stage. We might be the only way that you get Simon Harris and Micheál Martin to any debate. They might say, look, we're not doing these debates unless there's 8 of us on stage, because then we each get our own way to shine and we all get to gang up on Sinn Féin. That could be how this goes.
Yeah, and just on Sinn Féin, we've seen their poll numbers ever reducing over the last number of months and ebbing away from the high in the mid 30s now down to back down to 25% again. And I think what the challenge here is, you know, if I actually look at Canada, the Economist had a very interesting article recently on how immigration and how it's being perceived by voters in Canada, and it's becoming an election issue now, and the big challenge that it's facing. Because, you know, if you look at Canada's policy on immigration, Canada is a country over the last, you know, since its official policy of what they call multiculturalism, since Pierre Trudeau, Justin Trudeau's father, was prime minister in the 70s and 80s, where they basically opened the country up to having a broad, open, and points-based, I would add, immigration system to attract immigrants that they wanted into the country to support their own economic development and growth, because their own birth rate, for example, of course, has also been has been declining. And it's served Canada very well, and their population has grown significantly. But under the current Liberal government, since Justin Trudeau took office in 2015, they have significantly increased the number of immigrant places into the country, of which I was a beneficiary of one, I would add. But to the point, for example, in the last in I think it was about two years ago or so, there was 1 million people who came into the country in the space of 1 year. Now, what's happened now is
just isn't Canada Canada's a country of about maybe 25 million or 40 million?
It's 40 million now.
40, yes, yeah.
Canada's 40 million now.
You're talking about that's probably about a 2-2.5% increase in the population.
Correct.
Just in 1 year. And if what I was saying there about that Bank of England study, if you're adding 2%, you're going to at least get maybe 3-4% increase in house prices alone from that factor.
Exactly. And Canada is, you know, it has been facing a significant housing crisis in its own right, with housing prices completely ballooned. You know, Vancouver now is known as one of the worst, if not the worst, property bubble in the world. And they have their own issues with respect to house building. And their problem with their immigration is also where they immigrate to. And they tend to have only immigrated to, you know, the certain metro areas, mostly Toronto, actually, which has further exacerbated the affordability crisis in that area as well. I say all of that because even in a country like Canada that's been built on immigration, many Irish immigrants like myself have gone and lived there and built a life there. Even the Canadians, I think, are starting to, this issue is starting to affect their political system as well. And you're starting to see that actually transcend now into political policy. Mm-hmm. All of the major parties starting to roll back their target numbers on immigration, and openly now accepting that the huge numbers that they accepted in over the last number of years have led to challenges on the economic front. Last thing I would add in Canada is on the debates, on the TV debates, they had TV debates with all parties, not just those who would be the would-be prime minister.
Okay, and how many people was that? Because I know in Canada you have the two main Liberals and Conservative. You have the NDP, which are also large, but you also have like Green, Quebecois.
You have the Green, yeah. So you have Green. So it's basically any party that holds at least a seat in Parliament.
At least one,
of course. At least one, of course. It's first past the post. It's harder for a party.
So that could be an aim-to rule then, because they have just one as well in our party.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think it's a case of, you know, having national representation, of course, harder to do in a first past the post system, which Canada has.
Yeah.
But it was five. And it wasn't about who would be the prime minister. It wasn't a prime ministerial debate. It was a general election debate. And that's the difference.
Okay. Fascinating. Well, Dale, it's been good to catch up with you. And yeah, we'll leave it there and talk to you next time.
Good to see you, David. Thanks again.
Thanks, Dale.